This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, it's Amna. I'm your host for this edition of the News Roundup. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly changing, and things may be different by the time you hear this episode. Stay up to date with all the latest by listening to your local NPR member station and visiting npr.org for all the latest. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. I'm Amna Nawaz of the PBS NewsHour, and it's time for another edition of the News Roundup. Let's get into it. We've had some fighting talk.
Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win.
A push for peace.
Given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. Yeah!
And a concession that came with a quote.
Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. For God will be with you wherever you go. From the bottom of my heart, thank you, America. God bless you.
With us this week to talk about all of that is Amanda Becker. She's the Washington correspondent for The 19th. That's a nonprofit newsroom reporting on gender, politics, and policy. Amanda, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And Robert Costa, chief election and campaign correspondent for CBS and co-author of Peril. Bob, welcome.
Great to be with you.
And here in the studio with me is Wendy Benjaminson. She's Washington's senior editor of Bloomberg News. Wendy, it's really good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, it was feisty. Last night, the president set out to use his third State of the Union address to, quote, wake up Congress and kickstart his general election campaign. With millions watching at home, it was a huge opportunity to promote his vision for the country and to counter those concerned about his age. And as before, Biden seemed to enjoy sparring with Republican hecklers. He repeatedly criticized Donald Trump, but never actually named his likely presidential adversary. So, Wendy, let's start with you. I'd love to kind of go around the horn and get your takes. What, if anything, stood out to you from last night?
Well, one of the first things that Biden had to do last night was to assuage the notion that he is too old, as every poll shows many, many voters think. And he did that. He was energetic. He was feisty. He left the teleprompter. I was watching to see if he was just going to stand there and read the speech or he was going to get into it. And get into it he did with, you know, sparring with Republicans. When they booed, he'd say, oh, you don't like that? It was really good old Joe Biden, old-fashioned politician.
Bob, what about you? What did you take away from last night?
The State of the Union is traditionally an opportunity for the president to update the Congress on his agenda. Sometimes they give long speeches that go over an hour. I think about President Bill Clinton doing that. Sometimes they send a letter, like President Thomas Jefferson did to Congress in 1801. What you saw last night from President Biden was the kickoff of the general election campaign against former President Donald Trump. Trump just days ago swept across all of the primaries, nearly all of them, on Super Tuesday, except for Vermont. And you saw Biden pivot towards the general election by reaching out to Nikki Haley, traditional Republican voters, quoting Ronald Reagan near the top of his speech, making an overture to them, saying there's room in the Democratic coalition for those types of voters.
Amanda, what stood out to you from the remarks we heard from the president last night?
Like Wendy was saying, it was really energetic. And I thought that, you know, I was noting and maybe even a little surprised at how proactive the president was in challenging some of the Republicans, like anticipating their heckling before it happened on certain issues. And one example would be an exchange about the infrastructure bill, where he said something along the lines of, if any of you don't want that money in your districts, let me know, and kind of laughed. And, you know, his cabinet and his administration is planning a big tour next week. They're going to be in many places around the country talking about that infrastructure bill because the president sees that as his greatest accomplishment so far. So, you know, it was a very energetic night. It was a, you know, an engaging speech, I thought. And sometimes these things can be pretty staid.
Wendy, as Amanda notes, he did go after his Republican, the Republicans in the chamber quite a bit. But last night was also notable because President Biden went after the justices of the Supreme Court who voted in favor of abolishing Roe v. Wade.
Those bragging about overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women. But they found out when reproductive freedom was on the ballot, we won in 2022 and 2020, and we'll win again in 2024.
Wendy, as we were watching this, he's sitting feet away from the justices who are all watching him deliver this address. Were you surprised by the tone and direction of his comments?
I was a little surprised. I wonder, though, if it was really directed at the Supreme Court justices who haven't really bragged about their decision as much as Republicans who have embraced this as permission to go ahead and ban it. And in that sense, they know that's a winner for Democrats and independents and those suburban women that everybody wants to have vote for them. And so in that sense, I think it was good. I did notice, as others have, that he never actually used the word abortion. Mm-hmm. He used the term reproductive rights, and maybe that was to, you know, bring in IVF and these other things that are on the brink of being banned. Or maybe it was his own discomfort with abortion sneaking up. But abortion apparently was in the text of the speech, and he avoided the word.
We're breaking down last night's State of the Union address delivered by President Biden, who at times was heckled. Here is how he responded to Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who showed up wearing her MAGA hat. This is when Biden at one point picked up a button that many Republican members were wearing, bearing the name of a University of Georgia student named Lincoln Riley, who police say was killed by an undocumented immigrant.
Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right. To her parents, I say, my heart goes out to you, having lost children myself. I understand. Folks, I would respectfully suggest my Republican friends owe it to the American people, get this bill done. We need to act now.
Bob, what did you make of that moment, which was one of several in which there was interaction between the president and others in the chamber, and also the language the president used in that response?
You see from President Biden in all of his exchanges this willingness to take on the Republican Party. And I think perhaps the most important exchange was the unscripted one he had with Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene about immigration. While he used a term that many in the Democratic Party do not like to describe undocumented migrants, President Biden did say the name of the young woman, Lincoln Riley, who was killed in Georgia. And he said he's going to take on immigration and border security in a serious way, whether it's trying to pressure Republicans to pass the legislation that's at a standstill on Capitol Hill. And that has been an issue I've encountered on the campaign trail that's been hovering over the Biden reelection campaign. A lot of voters have concerns about it. Their reservations about Biden's position on the border is really a hindrance to them going over and voting for Biden for reelection. So for him to take on one of his biggest critics face to face in front of the whole country while she's wearing a Make America Great Again red cap inside the Congress, that was an opportunity for Biden to speak to an issue that many of his critics and voters who are on the fence perceive as a weakness and address it head on.
Wendy, how did the president's remarks there go over with people in his own party?
Well, that's just it. While he may have assuaged concerns, at least temporarily, about his age and mental acuity, he didn't do much to help himself with Muslim American voters, Arab American voters, any voters who are concerned about Israel's conduct of the war, nor with young voters. And those are constituencies who have been voting uncommitted in the primaries, who may stay home, and who he really, really needs to win states like Michigan and Wisconsin and those very important swing states. So when he said Israel has a right to go after Hamas, and then he also sort of countered it with a little bit of, you know, but Palestinians need to survive, and this is a little too much. I don't think it went far enough for people like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and the young voters who are concerned about this as well.
We also did, of course, have the traditional Republican response, which is always fraught and high stakes in another way for the person delivering it. Republicans this year selected first-term Alabama Senator Katie Britt. At 42, she is one of the youngest senators currently serving.
What we saw was the performance of a permanent politician who has actually been in office for longer than I've been alive.
Amanda, what do you make of both the selection of Senator Britt to deliver that response and the actual response that she delivered?
Republicans have had a string of women delivering responses, and I think that speaks to the fact that they know that they're in trouble with women electorally. I mean, white women did stick with Trump for the most part last time, but he didn't win. Like, you know, they need to have women in their corner in order to win not only Trump's election, but their own Senate elections in state white races. And they know that. And so that's why they would choose someone like Senator Britt. She's also, as you said, young. And this is, you know, these are two candidates that are kind of struggling with young people. Young people are feeling very kind of left out of the political process right now. Like, they feel like they don't have options that appeal to them. And so they chose both a woman and a young woman to kind of speak to those two groups. I mean, if I had to choose one word overall to characterize the response, it would be jarring. She delivered this speech, which kind of had reminiscent of Trump's American Carnage speech, but from her kitchen with a smile. So it was a little bit jarring to watch.
We are rounding up the week's biggest news. We'll be back with more after this short break. Stay with us.
On NPR's Throughline,
we cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.
Let's get back to the conversation. Well, voters across 16 more states made their preferences clear this week, and it seems voters will have a familiar set of choices this fall.
They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one.
Former President Donald Trump did not win enough delegates to clinch the GOP nomination after the Super Tuesday primaries, but former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley decided it was over. She officially ended her campaign Wednesday morning. So, Wendy, kick us off here. What are your takeaways from Super Tuesday?
Well, as you and I were discussing earlier, I've been in newsrooms for a lot of Super Tuesdays, and I have never been so underwhelmed as I was.
Less than super.
That's Tuesday. I mean, there's only so many times you can type Trump wins, Biden wins, Trump wins, Biden wins. But so the presidentials, you know, were expected. It was interesting to see that Nikki Haley still is not resonating among a majority of Republican voters, even though she has designated a certain, maybe a quarter of the Republican primary voters who are interested in someone else. And now those voters are the ones that Biden went after the day after Super Tuesday to say, come into the tent, the water's fine. So he did that. And I think now what everybody's on the edge of their seats for is to see whether Nikki Haley will be honestly true to her word that Donald Trump is dangerous and is unfit for office and all of that, or turn around and endorse him and try to get into his administration.
Well, speaking of Nikki Haley, let's take a quick minute just to listen to what she did and didn't say when announcing the end of her campaign on Wednesday morning.
I have always been a conservative Republican and always supported the Republican nominee. But on this question, as she did on so many others, Margaret Thatcher provided some good advice when she said, quote, "Never just follow the crowd. Always make up your own mind." It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that.
So, Bob, Haley did not endorse Trump as the presumptive GOP nominee. Tell us a little bit about how you see her impact moving forward, her voters' impact moving forward in this race. And I'll also put to you a question from Ken in Sturgis, Michigan, who writes in and says, Nikki Haley suspended her campaign earlier in the week. I've heard others use the same word. Is there some magic in it? Why not just stop or cancel? Bob?
Nikki Haley is not the leader of a political movement, but she is emblematic of a movement within the Republican Party. Traditional Republicans who feel lost in a party that's now so dominated by former President Trump. She's accrued some delegates, and on a personal and political level, she has some political capital she could spend in the coming months, perhaps negotiating an endorsement with the Trump campaign for a primetime speaking slot at the Republican National Convention this summer in Milwaukee. But more importantly, in the coming months, will be what Haley represents, which is that voter I've encountered so many places, especially in suburban areas around Philadelphia, in the South, in the industrial Midwest, who like Trump's policies, like how he's outlined an agenda on the economy and the border, but have real reservations about his conduct, especially about January 6th and the way he talks about migrants, women, people of color. And Haley has been critical of Trump and said in her speech this week that he needs to earn the support of people like her in the Republican Party. But it's not evident to me yet that Trump is feeling any pressure to unite the party around him, that he really believes that President Biden alone can be enough to bring Republicans home.
And to Ken's question, Bob, about the suspension, is that something to do with financial implications of a campaign? We know she's sitting on quite a bit of a war chest still.
Oftentimes in presidential campaigns, there's a decision to suspend because it does leave open the remote possibility that the campaign could be reengaged. And we are in historic circumstances with this campaign. In just a few weeks, starting March 25th, Trump will be sitting in a Manhattan courtroom to face a criminal trial over hush money payments he made to a porn star. So there's the potential that come May or June of this year, Trump is a convicted felon. And then he also has the looming possibility of the Supreme Court saying he's not immune from prosecution at some point in April or May. And then he could face trials on a federal level for January 6th and classified records, though it's no guarantee that those would happen before an election if they would happen at all. All that's to say, Haley suspending leaves open the possibility that she could always put the key back in the car should something drastic happen in the coming months with Trump.
Bob is absolutely right on all of that, of course. But in addition to that, under FEC rules, the reason a lot of candidates suspend their campaigns is it allows them to continue to raise money and spend it to retire debts. And so, Doug Burgum, all those other candidates also suspended their campaigns as a financial status until they decide what to do. But Bob is right. The most likely person to jump back in would be Haley.
Amanda, you cover Congress for the 19th, a nonprofit news site we should mention named after the constitutional amendment that gave women the right to vote, at least on paper. And we should note, not a lot of women run for president. And Nikki Haley outlasted a number of other challengers. She made history while doing so as the first woman to win a Republican primary. How are you reflecting on that campaign and its impact on the party?
You know, it's in some ways it's difficult to separate kind of the historic nature of Nikki Haley as a candidate as being both a woman and being Asian American, her parents were immigrants from India, from kind of a party that's really kind of in the grip of Donald Trump, right? Because right now, if there is a mold for a candidate, a presidential candidate in the Republican Party, it is Donald Trump. So it's hard to kind of separate out that from Nikki Haley and kind of the historic nature of this. What I will say is a very clear takeaway, as Robert mentioned, she's sitting on a lot of money. If something happens, she can get back in. And, you know, women candidates struggle as compared to men in raising money. Women of color, it's even more difficult. In the Republican Party, it's more challenging than in the Democratic Party. So I think the kind of enthusiasm from deep-pocketed donors to get behind Nikki Haley's campaign does say something about kind of changes and shifts within the Republican Party in terms of what, you know, business leaders look for in a world leader.
Before we talk more about Super Tuesday takeaways, I want to back up to Monday for just a moment, because that is when the Supreme Court ruled unanimously against the Colorado voters trying to remove former President Trump from their primary ballot. The voters argued he's ineligible because of a section of the 14th Amendment that was ratified after the Civil War. It bars candidates from office if they've participated in an insurrection. So, Wendy, why did the Supreme Court disagree with Colorado's decision to remove Trump from the primary ballot?
Well, it was not a terribly surprising decision, and I think even people who wish Donald Trump weren't running for president could see some of the logic in it. The 14th Amendment, which was written right after the Civil War, has a clause in it, or a provision in it, that says that insurrectionists may not hold federal office. And this was designed so that Confederate officials could not, in the reunited states, could not hold federal office. It was a way to punish Confederate officers and office holders. In this case, there is no legal proof yet. Donald Trump has not been convicted of insurrection. There are deep opinions on both sides. And so what they said was that, and they actually didn't address that. But what they said was the 14th Amendment leaves it up to the Congress to decide whether someone is an insurrectionist, not individual states, because then you would have election ballot chaos. You would be on the ballot in some states and not on the ballot in others. There are some legal scholars, though, who say that this ruling could leave the door open, if Donald Trump wins the Electoral College, to not certify the 2024 election based on the notion that they are Congress and they think he's an insurrectionist. This is a long shot, and I think it's something more for legal scholars to sit around their port and discuss. But because it would be political suicide for the Democrats to do that. But it's possible, and it's a fun sort of parlor game to think about.
Well, Bob, how do you look at this ruling? I mean, the court doesn't offer unanimous decisions too often. How notable is it that they had agreement on this one?
It's somewhat notable, but it's not surprising. The Supreme Court outlined in its ruling that it doesn't believe a state Supreme Court has the right to start policing who's on the ballot on a federal level. And so most legal experts didn't expect this to go through and for the Supreme Court to agree with the Colorado Supreme Court. At the same time, Trump's issues with the Supreme Court are just beginning. He might be on the Colorado ballot and on ballots across the country, but he still has this presidential immunity question. And we haven't had a presidential immunity issue before the court at this level with these kind of stakes since Watergate 50 years ago, with Richard Nixon wondering about his status as a president in terms of prosecution. And now Trump is a former president trying to see if he's immune from being prosecuted for conduct while in office. It's going to be highly intriguing, but also significantly important for this election to see if the Supreme Court, which is, there is always the possibility, rules he is immune from prosecution. This is a conservative court in some ways, though there's not an expectation among my legal sources that the court is going to say he's immune from prosecution. There's a likelihood, many top lawyers say, that he will have to face some level of prosecution, though the scope of it could be contextual based on what the Supreme Court decides ultimately after it has this deliberation in April. And the timing's going to be very delicate, because Judge Chutkin in Washington, D.C. with the January 6th trial is going to have to decide, can this really be done before an election? How close is too close to an election? A lot of issues on the horizon with the Supreme Court with Trump, even though he got through this ballot issue.
Back to Super Tuesday and some of the down-ballot races that didn't necessarily get as much attention as the presidential. And some of those primary ballots included a lot of other names. Many House matchups were also decided, and some of which could help to determine which party controls Congress next year. Amanda, give us some highlights. What House contests were you watching this week?
I was watching a lot of the contests in California. This is an area where it's a really populated state, obviously. So there's a lot of seats up. And it could, you know, be determinative in terms of who controls the House. It also has the added dynamic of three Democratic members of the House decided to try for the open Senate seat in California. And under California election law, you cannot concurrently run for multiple federal offices. And so they had to give up their House seats to do that. So Adam Schiff won that Senate primary. He was the top vote getter. He proceeds to November, but Katie Porter did not, and Barbara Lee did not. And Barbara Lee's in a very safe Democratic seat, so that's less interesting. But Katie Porter comes from a swing district she flipped in 2018 in Orange County. And in that race, it was also, you know, one where, you know, AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobby, is planning to spend a lot of money in Democratic primaries this year. That was one of the first ones they decided to spend money in. And it's actually not really clear why, because the two Democratic candidates have public positions on Israel that are quite similar. But, you know, you had a Republican win that district in that primary because they're nonpartisan primaries. And so, you know, you can start to extrapolate how difficult some of these general election races might be in those House districts in Southern California.
Well, there's also big news in a race that could decide control of the Senate next year. Arizona independent Kyrsten Sinema announced Tuesday that she will not run for re-election this year.
I love Arizona, and I am so proud of what we've delivered. Because I choose civility, understanding, listening, working together to get stuff done, I will leave the Senate at the end of this year.
Wendy, why is this a big deal?
It's a big deal because Arizona, first of all, is a state that's sort of on the cusp of political change. It used to be very, very conservative. I mean, Barry Goldwater and, you know, people like that. It is increasingly becoming Democratic. Biden did carry it in 2020, to the consternation of Fox News on election night. But Kyrsten Sinema was in the mold of Joe Manchin, Mitt Romney. She was one of those very centrist senators who would always sort of be at the negotiating table. She was a power player in her own right. She's sort of overshadowed by Manchin, but she really was a power player in her own right. She was known for her sort of kooky approach to dressing as a U.S. senator that we all had a lot of fun with. But her decision to drop out leaves the race between Ruben Gallego, who is a liberal Democrat, maybe not super progressive, but to the left of Sinema, and Carrie Lake, a Trump acolyte who is still relitigating not only the 2020 presidential election, but her own defeat in the governor's race in 2020. And so this election really also shows that people in the center don't have a place in politics right now. You've got now Ruben Gallego, however, did raise $1 million in the day after Sinema announced that she was dropping out. That's probably a lot of outside Democratic money trying to fight Carrie Lake. Carrie Lake, if she doesn't win, is probably on Trump's VP list. So it's become a very, very interesting and sort of, a race for everyone to watch.
Well, speaking of races to watch, Bob, I want to get your quick take on a gubernatorial race in North Carolina. The state's current governor, Roy Cooper, is term limited. He is a Democrat. And Democrats hope that Attorney General Josh Stein will replace Cooper. Republican primary voters have put their support behind Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. Why is this a race to keep an eye on, Bob?
This is really a race to keep an eye on because Democrats think they can hold on with Josh Stein, the attorney general in North Carolina, facing off Mark Robinson, a Republican lieutenant governor who's made incendiary comments in recent weeks that have been revealed, including saying maybe it's time to turn back the clock on women voting in this country. That's gotten a lot of attention and brought the spotlight to this race.
We'll be back with more of the News Roundup in just a moment.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime. wherever you listen to podcasts.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
The day's top headlines, local stories from your community, your next podcast binge listen. You can have it all in one place, your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Let's get back to the roundup and turn now to Israel. Since Israel's war in Gaza began, the Biden administration has been careful about criticizing Israel. But Biden's State of the Union address Thursday night went there.
Israel must allow more aid into Gaza to ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. And they're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. To the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip.
Bob, what did you make of the way that President Biden chose to address the Israel-Hamas war and also his message to Israeli officials?
What you've seen from the Biden-Harris administration is a turn in recent weeks toward the articulation of the word ceasefire. Now, there are critics who were sitting there in the House chamber last night who say they want a far more permanent ceasefire become the policy of the Biden administration. But you do hear now talk of a ceasefire from both the president and the vice president. And that was part of the prelude to the State of the Union for the administration to start putting out pointers and talking points on that issue, because they know that there's a deep concern among many Democrats and some independents and others about how Israel is handling its war with Hamas, and Netanyahu's leadership in particular is something that's under intense scrutiny. And it's not going away, but because the president is pushing for a ceasefire, trying to address the issue of humanitarian aid, many Democrats are telling me in the past 12, 24 hours that he's doing a lot, or at least as much as he can, to somewhat quiet the criticism. But the criticism is pretty deep with people who have been following everything since the fall and winter. There's more work to do, and that's why the Biden administration keeps going back to places like Michigan to huddle with Democratic voters, especially those with personal ties to those in the region.
And it's worth noting the president's remarks last night on Israel and Gaza actually echoed Vice President Kamala Harris's remarks on Sunday.
The Israeli government must do more to significantly increase the flow of aid. No excuses. They must open new border crossings. They must not impose any unnecessary restrictions on the delivery of aid.
That was Vice President Harris speaking on Sunday. And Wendy, we saw some reporting from NBC News that several current U.S. officials, one former, said that the National Security Council had toned down Harris's speech. Harris's team denies those claims. But what do we know about that reporting and what may have been in the initial speech?
Well, as Bob said, this has been an incredibly narrow tightrope for the Biden administration. The Mideast is always a difficult political maneuver, and with the growing strength of Muslim and Arab American voters, with people of color, with young voters really surprised by the response of Israel to that horrific attack on October 7th. And then you have traditional Democrats and Republicans, Jews, religious Christians, people like that who are very, very pro-Israel. And so it's you're either on one side or the other. And Biden is and the administration are trying very hard to be tough on Israel, to be critical of Israel, let me say. They're not really being tough, but tough on Israel and give them these instructive sort of statements like Biden did last night while still being loyal to Israel. The trouble is that Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, isn't going to listen to any words. He is running his administration the way he sees fit. He has been waiting for this moment to really attack Hamas and other Palestinian terror groups. And the response, you know, is known to be over the top, but he knows the United States is going to be with him. I think if the administration really wanted to get Netanyahu to listen, they would have to do something dramatic, which probably politically they can't do, like cut off aid to Israel.
Speaking of aid, we know that both the president and vice president's call for an increase of humanitarian aid to Gaza wasn't all talk. On Saturday, the U.S. delivered more than 38,000 meals to the region. They airdropped a second round of aid into northern Gaza on Tuesday. And in his State of the Union address last night, President Biden announced that the U.S. is building a temporary pier on Gaza's coast to deliver more humanitarian aid. So, Amanda, the Biden administration has been criticized for its continued military support of Israel, especially by progressives. Are these kind of moves enough to quiet that criticism?
Probably not, is the short answer. I think it's coming too late for a lot of people who really care about this. We have seen how the airdrops are a literal drop in the bucket in terms of addressing the crisis there from a humanitarian standpoint. And you hear that from people who are there in the Gaza Strip right now. And this pier, you know, I don't know how long it will take to get it built, but we're in a situation now where the hunger and the need is so great and so pressing that any additional delay is going to be, you know, add to this calamity. So I think that this, you know, could potentially help if it works, but I think it's going to be difficult to get some of these voters back in his corner after this because just the disappointment and the sadness has been so great.
Well, we should mention, too, the top Israeli official, Benny Gantz, met with U.S. leaders in Washington this week. That was against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's wishes. Gantz is an Israeli war cabinet member and really Netanyahu's top political rival. So, Bob, tell us a little bit more about who Gantz met with and what the main takeaways were of those meetings.
It's a complicated political and diplomatic dance for Benny Gantz because a lot of people, both right and left, on Capitol Hill, my sources, would like to deal with the centrist rival of Netanyahu rather than Netanyahu himself. And you see in Gantz someone who's also careful when he's meeting, and he's saying his National Unity Party is just going to keep kind of working in the trenches. And you never know what happens in Israeli politics, so it's not surprising to see Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, or Vice President Kamala Harris doing what they can to meet with Gantz and see what happens. Mitch McConnell did the same, and Tony Blinken meeting with Gantz. And in a sense, Gantz is a way to get through to Netanyahu. And I pay attention to what the vice president said after she met with Gantz. She said, look, Israel has a right to defend itself, deal with Hamas as much as possible, but she underscored the humanitarian conditions in Gaza had alarmed her and the Biden administration, and they wanted to make sure they were doing all they could to get a convoy to northern Gaza. And so it's a way for the administration to work Netanyahu without working him directly.
Wendy, how do you look at this? Is this visit especially significant amid the disapproval of Netanyahu, certainly among some U.S. lawmakers, but also we hear a really vocal outcry on the ground from hostage families in Israel?
Absolutely. And let's not forget that some of those hostages are either dual citizen Americans or outright American citizens who are suffering, you know, somewhere in Gaza. The Biden was careful not to meet with Gantz when he was here. That would have been a real slap in the face to Benjamin Netanyahu, as Benny Gantz is an opposition leader. It would be as if Donald Trump went to Israel and got an audience, you know. So that was one of the reasons against it. I just think they're, again, trying to walk this very, very narrow tightrope in meeting with Netanyahu's critics and trying to address the humanitarian crisis. I do think this pier that they're building could be a really good step toward feeding hungry people. And one of the things about Joe Biden is, you know, he is the kind of person who sees hungry people and wants to do something about it. So, you know, even if it's irritating to a top ally.
To Amanda's earlier point that she raised, do we know how long this kind of effort will take and what it would entail?
I think it's going to, from what I read yesterday, I think it's going to take a few weeks to build this. The U.S. military, the Army Corps of Engineers, is good at this. They know how to do this. They can build it pretty quickly. Of course, the security around that pier will be will be key, because someone will want to blow it up for some reason. So that will be the interesting thing to watch.
As we know, that aid is getting more and more critical by the day. Well, we've got some notes from you out there listening coming in now. Mary Ann wrote in on Gaza to say that 38,000 meals are a joke. Thousands will die waiting for aid. We do know that UN officials are warning of imminent famine for many people inside Gaza. But this was a key part of President Biden's State of the Union, and you're still sharing your thoughts on that State of the Union address. David from Cleveland writes, "I was much more impressed with Biden's address last night than I thought I would be." A comment from Angela asking, "Who invited George Santos to the State of the Union address?" And Kim writes in, "They are both too old," speaking about Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump, as she says, is the political system in our country. Let's check in now on Congress. We know House lawmakers are pressuring House Speaker Mike Johnson to advance additional aid to Ukraine and other foreign assistance. There's a small group of moderate Republicans and Democrats who introduced an emergency spending bill to provide military aid for Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific. It would also tie this assistance to changes in immigration policy. Wendy, what are the chances that this will go anywhere in a chamber that's really been stalled around these issues?
I'm not holding out a lot of hope that that aid is going to get passed. One of the things that sort of struck me from a tradition point of view is that speaking out against Russian aggression doesn't get both sides of the aisle standing up. You know, that used to be all that would get both sides of the aisle standing up. And you know, Mike Johnson had a very dramatic face for a soft-spoken guy last night, rolling his eyes and shaking his head. And every time Ukraine sort of came up, I don't know what tools the administration has left in its kit to try to get this going, unless the situation in Ukraine continues to go downhill or become so dire that there's just that political will grows in this country to help them out.
Let's turn to an update on a story we've been following closely the last few weeks. On Thursday, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed a bill into law that protects patients and providers from legal liability related to in vitro fertilization treatment. Late last month, a state Supreme Court ruling said that embryos are legally considered children, halting treatment across much of the state. Jen White and the 1A team were in Alabama earlier this week. They spoke to Jamie Hurd, an IVF patient in Birmingham.
Once I saw the news with the Supreme Court ruling, my heart dropped, absolutely dropped. And the one thing that I kept telling my husband, because he kept asking, well, how are you feeling? And the one thing that I could equate it to was I was feeling like I was grieving the loss of a loved one. Because we had just started our second cycle, ready to have a second kid. And it seems like that choice was being taken away from us.
That was Jamie Hurd talking about the Alabama court decision that paused her IVF treatment. Amanda, when you look at what happened in Alabama, what does the swift passage and the signing of this bill in Alabama tell us about the politics of limiting IVF in that state, but also nationally?
It means that Republicans realize this is disastrous politics for them. I mean, you heard in the State of the Union response last night, she brought up IVF as well and her support for it. And this is going to be, advocates for reproductive rights in Alabama are already warning that this legislation isn't enough to make them feel fully comfortable. They want a constitutional amendment to this effect, because legislation, right, if you get a new group of state lawmakers in, they could pass a different bill. They could repeal this. They could have different legislation. So they're saying what they really need is this written into the state constitution. More broadly, in terms of, you know, IVF and what this case has shown the country, it's proving the point that reproductive rights advocates have been making for years, that this isn't just about abortion, that restricting abortion could have cascading effects on fertility treatments and technology, on contraception, and in other areas of our healthcare. And so, you know, I think Republicans are doing what they can to try to fix this politically and show that, you know, just because they oppose abortion doesn't mean they oppose all these other things. But they're going to be having to, I think, put out fires all over the place to make this case to voters.
Well, before we go, I'd love to peek into each of your notebooks, if you don't mind. In a sentence or two, could you just tell us what you're paying attention to and what you're really going to follow this next week? Wendy, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I was so glad that viewer mentioned George Santos. What a weird moment last night. He shows up in the House chamber in silver shoes and a sparkly collar, and he still has House floor access, even though he was expelled from Congress. And then, lo and behold, he announces he's running again. Mm-hmm. So if a House race to watch will be George Santos versus Nick LaLota out on Long Island.
Amanda, what about you?
I'm thinking a little bit farther out because I'm actually on vacation next week.
Good for you.
I'm really paying attention to the buildup to the oral arguments this month in the mifepristone case, the medication abortion case before the Supreme Court.
And Bob, over to you.
Let's just see if President Biden can keep up the momentum from this State of the Union. A lot of Democrats tell me this is like a reset for his presidency and campaign. Can it last?
All right. Our thanks this week to Bloomberg's Wendy Benjaminson, from the 19th, Amanda Becker, and Robert Costa, chief election and campaign correspondent for CBS and co-author of Peril. Thanks to you all. Before we head to the global edition of the News Roundup, a remembrance. Akira Toriyama, the legendary anime and manga artist and creator of Dragon Ball, has died. The Japanese artist also worked on the Dragon Quest and Chrono Trigger video games. Akira Toriyama created Dragon Ball in 1984, and it's become a cultural juggernaut. It's one of the best-selling manga series of all time, with over 260 million copies sold worldwide and the anime broadcast in over 80 countries. He was 68 years old. We'll be back with the global edition of the News Roundup in just a moment. Stay with us.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
Let's turn back now to the week's biggest international headlines. Here to guide us through is David Rennie. He's bureau chief for The Economist and co-host of the Drum Tower podcast. He joins us from Beijing. Hi, David.
Hello.
Nancy Youssef is national security correspondent at The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
And Jack Detch is Pentagon and national security reporter at Foreign Policy. He joins me here in studio. Jack, good to see you.
Good to be with you, Amna.
So let's begin with Gaza and what we heard from President Biden in the State of the Union address last night. David, kick us off here and give us a sense of how much of a difference some of the president's announcements will make on the ground when it comes to providing humanitarian relief.
I mean, there is no doubt that if you could get a port onto a coast which currently doesn't have a functioning port, that is going to make a difference. But I think everyone is very clear that this is in part an attempt to put political leverage on the Israeli government, because there's no need for a port if you could just get trucks across the normal border checkpoints into the Gaza Strip from Israel and from the south on the Egyptian border. And there is a political obstacle in the way of those trucks. Now, there is a security issue, that is true, and the Israelis would also be allowed to screen shipments coming in by sea, for example, from Cyprus, which seems to be the corridor that's taking shape now with international support from the EU, Britain, many others. But the truth is that the Israelis are also accused by allies of theirs, including the British government and increasing pressure from the American government, of not doing all they can to get aid just the regular way on trucks, hundreds of trucks needed every day across that border. And you're seeing, in some cases, extreme right-wing protesters physically blocking access to those border crossings, and the police not doing anything, and those protesters seeming to be given tacit approval from some of the members of Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition government. So, yes, it's a good thing that the president announced in the State of the Union this temporary port that would be built. Yes, it's a good thing that the European Union and others are about to start ships leaving the island of Cyprus, about 200 miles off the coast of Gaza, as soon as this weekend. It's even a good thing that a few meals fell by parachute from the sky from an American transport plane. But all of these are an admission of political failure to get trucks in the normal way across the land border.
Nancy, what do you make of the talks over aid so far, and also some concerns we've had from Israeli officials that they're concerned Hamas could be intercepting some of the aid, that it benefits them, that they're siphoning aid from the people who actually need it, and that's part of the reason they've been standing in the way of more aid deliveries. What do you make of that?
Well, you're right. We have heard that throughout this, but as you know, it's reached a dire humanitarian crisis. And the Israelis are open to options by way of sea, in that they will let Cypriots, for example, inspect the loads of trucks and the supplies on them with Israeli inspectors. And so there seem to be practical solutions outside of sort of stopping trucks when they come by sea. The challenge is that building these temporary piers, getting ships in, is potentially a weeks-long proposition when the crisis is now and imminent. And so while there have been concerns, the fact that we have seen means to find alternative routes and alternative ways of getting aid in faster by way of sea, I think suggests that there are other alternatives rather than stopping aid altogether at such a critical time. To give you a sense.
Oh, sorry, Nancy, please go ahead.
I was just going to say, just so your listeners know, to give you a sense of what's required, it's about 400 truckloads a day. And right now, a few dozen are getting in every week.
And of course, a ceasefire deal being done is central to those aid lines reopening. And in last night's State of the Union address, President Biden did make it clear that a deal has to get done.
Temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day. And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza and ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire.
Jack, bring us up to speed. There have been stops and starts in this process. What is the deal on the table right now, and where are the gaps between the parties?
So when we last left off, the deal looked like about 40 hostages being released from the Gaza Strip, Israeli hostages, in exchange for a six-week ceasefire, as well as an increase in aid deliveries. So you would have seen some of those restrictions that both the Israelis and some pro-Israeli demonstrators, obviously, as David mentioned, kind of coming free, as well as potentially hundreds of Palestinian prisoners from jails being released from Israeli custody, and back to Palestine, which has been a major demand and a major stopping point in the talks. Those seem to really have stalled at this point in Paris, where they've been ongoing. And now sort of the question lies, as we're reaching Ramadan, that was expected to be kind of a hard stop for any battle plan, especially with the Israelis potentially seeking to go into Rafah. The optics of that situation, with about 1.5 million people down there, many of them in refugee camps, just would potentially set up a tragic situation. And so negotiators have been trying to stall that off. But Ramadan hits on Sunday. It doesn't look likely that we're going to have a deal by that point.
And this week, there was also a key member of Israel's war cabinet, Benny Gantz, who met with political leaders in Washington and in London. He was once a political foe of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but Gantz is a centrist politician who joined the war cabinet after the October 7th attacks, in a move that was widely seen as one that would bring unity to the country. Here now is Vice President Kamala Harris speaking to CBS right before her meeting with Gantz.
Well, we're going to discuss a number of things in terms of the priorities that certainly we have, which includes getting a hostage deal done, getting aid in, and then getting that six-week ceasefire. You know, the president and I have been very clear that Israel has a right to defend itself, that we have got to make sure that innocent civilians aren't being killed, and that we've got to get these hostages out.
David, we should point out that Gantz's trip was not authorized by the Israeli government. So what should we take away from the fact that the visit happened, that he was meeting with U.S. officials, and what it means for Israel's leadership?
I think it's diplomacy, but also an enormous dose of politics. Remember that Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, has not set foot yet in the White House under President Joe Biden's time in office, because the Americans are enormously frustrated, even as they continue to try and make this balancing act of making sure the Israelis feel the Americans are on their side. The Biden administration says that's the only way that America maintained its leverage. And so you have this extraordinary situation that America is still supplying a lot of arms to Israel, a lot of money to Israel, but is essentially embracing and offering a very high-level visit to a man who, the opinion polls tell us, would win an election against Benjamin Netanyahu if there was an election held tomorrow, who is in this wartime coalition cabinet, this war cabinet, but is clearly an enormous rival. And we saw Israeli media reporting that Benjamin Netanyahu said to Benny Gantz, allegedly, there is only one prime minister. And so clearly, if that's accurate, Netanyahu sees this as an attempt to sort of treat one of his own war cabinet, his great rival, as a shadow prime minister that the Americans, and in fact the British also welcomed Benny Gantz, can treat as a kind of a future leader who would be more trustworthy and someone who they could do business with. But that said, there was also really important diplomatic business done, because the Americans, the British and other allies of Israel are desperate to find ways to send signals to Israel that they sympathize with Israel's right to defend itself. They absolutely sympathize with the horrors inflicted on Israelis by the Hamas attack on October the 7th, but that Israel has to realize that even its best friends are losing patience. And you saw, for example, the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, David Cameron, saying exactly that. Our patience needs to run thin, sending very clear messages to Benny Gantz that that you know there has to be much quicker moves towards a ceasefire, much quicker moves towards a deal that allows hostages for a ceasefire, and then you know moves towards something more sustainable, like a two-state solution. And so using this as a way to send a shot across the bows of Benjamin Netanyahu, but also to send some hard messages to a man who perhaps is more willing to listen than some other members of the government.
Last night in his State of the Union address, President Joe Biden announced plans to establish a temporary port on the Gaza coast to boost deliveries of humanitarian aid. Jack, walk us through what we know about how this port will be set up and what it will require of U.S. troops.
So this would be U.S. military engineers operating off the coast of the Gaza Strip, not actually putting their boots on the ground, as Biden has specified. That's one really prerequisite of American involvement. It would take them about 36 to 60 days to actually have this operational pier. It would be connected to a makeshift railroad or track coming from the land in the Gaza Strip. And it would allow that aid coming from the United Arab Emirates through Cyprus that the Cypriots are inspecting to then actually be transitioned into Gaza. It's seen as a much more efficient way of actually distributing the aid. I mean, you've seen the images of the Gazans running to the American airdropped aid on the beaches in the past several weeks. It's just a brutal scrum. Aid officials say that, you know, when you drop aid like that on thousands of people, maybe 10, 20, 50 people actually end up getting the aid. It doesn't necessarily go to the right people. So this is seen as potentially a more efficient way to implement this. But again, the clock is ticking. The politics are involved. And as you said, Amna, over 30,000 dead in Gaza right now, a potential declaration of famine. So it's just a question of if this is going to happen fast enough.
Nancy, follow up on what Jack is talking about here, that aid, or the airdrop, rather, from the U.S. into northern Gaza earlier this week. That was over 35,000 meals, we understand. Where does that stand in terms of the need on the ground? And why have those aid drops been so controversial?
So if you let me do journalist math, which is as simple as possible, if there are 2.2 million people in Gaza, then they need 6.6 million meals every day, right? These aid drops, as you've noted, are 38,000. There have been three of them. So let's do 120,000. That's the gap between what's being provided and what's being transported. I don't want to take away from this because everything counts. But the need isn't being met. And then logistically, it presents a lot of challenges. Jack spelled out some of them quite well. In addition, those numbers are predicated on them all landing correctly. They don't always do so. They reach a limited population. There have been reports that some have died from these parachutes not opening. And so they only can answer the issue at hand in a very, very limited way, and they pose risks. The need so surpasses what airdrops can do, and there are risks on the ground to doing them. And so I think that's why we're starting to see talk about using ships, which can provide hundreds of truckloads a day, much closer to the demand. And I think historically, as a military correspondent, when we've reached a point where the U.S. is looking at airdrops, it's a it's a result of other options, more preferable options, not being available or used. And I think David spelled that out quite nicely earlier. And so it's for all those reasons that it's controversial. Again, I don't want to take away from it, because it's not for me to say that they don't count. If you're someone on the ground and it's reaching you, it's everything. But it's not enough for a really burgeoning crisis on the ground.
David, we should also note this week it was revealed that the U.S. has sent tens of thousands of weapons, including bombs and precision-guided munitions, to Israel since the October 7th attacks. Congress was only officially notified of two of those shipments. Israel does receive more than $3 billion in military aid every year from Washington. What should we understand about the public disclosure around those shipments, or the lack of one here? And also, what we should understand about Israeli concerns about U.S. pressure on Netanyahu and how that could affect future weapons sales.
I mean, you see here the tremendous dilemma on the American government, because, you know, President Biden has said that he is a committed Zionist. They believe in these Israel as an absolutely vital partner, an ally, a fellow democracy. And yet the government that we have in Israel is absolutely the most right-wing and extreme government in Israel's history, is absolutely opposed to many of the things that the Americans and other allies believe are needed to end this war. And so you see this terrible dilemma. How do you show support for Israel, the nation, Israel and its people, and yet that support clearly involves a very strong military element, and it always has done in the American-Israeli relationship, but how do you support Israel, the nation, without arming the worst elements in Israel, the government? And I think that this is where you see this balance, this balancing act that's very clearly being carried out by the Biden administration, which is to try and maintain leverage, unique leverage, by being their closest military supporter and ally, their indispensable supporter and partner, in the hopes that this will at some point allow America to sort of bend the curve of where Israel is going. But at the same time, you have, as people have been commenting this week, the extraordinary spectacle of American military transports dropping food from the sky, as well as deliveries of arms, of bombs that are going to be dropped by Israel on the same Gaza Strip. It's utterly illogical. And the only explanation is this balancing act of trying to see if maintaining that very strong support by America keeps the Israelis listening to Americans who are trying to urge them to change course. But it's an agonizing situation. And clearly, one of the reasons for secrecy is that it's also incredibly damaging to Joe Biden domestically with his own party, where, you know, many Democrats are extremely unhappy about the fact that they're sending arms in this way to Israel.
Well, David, staying with you for a moment on this, there's a related story from Canada I wanted to ask you about, where weapon sales to Israel from Canada have come under fire from pro-Palestinian and human rights advocates there. They filed a lawsuit against the Canadian government to stop it from allowing companies to export military goods and technology to Israel. And since October 7th, Ottawa's authorized at least $21 million worth of new permits for military exports to Israel. Tell us about the lawsuit and the kind of impact it could have.
So we've seen this group, which is there's a Palestinian aid group, Al-Haq, and then a Canadian human rights group, which have filed a federal lawsuit. And they say that under Canadian law, that if you have a substantial risk that Canadian exports could be used to violate international law, and in this case, they say, you know, for example, serious acts of violence against women and children, then it is illegal for the Canadian government to issue export permits. And in fact, we've seen the Canadian foreign ministry saying they haven't issued any permits for lethal weapons for some time to Israel, for a really quite a long time, and that this is only about non-lethal military equipment. And you say it's $21 million, which in military terms is almost nothing. So this is largely symbolic. And I think what it shows you, and it's similar to a case that happened in February in the Netherlands, where a court ordered the Dutch government to block exports of parts for F-35 fighter jets. What you're really seeing is that the Netherlands, Canada, these are Western democracies that do not believe they should export weapons to sort of genocidal or human rights abusing countries. They should only export them to friendly democracies. And what are we seeing here? It's that Israel's government is testing to the very limits the idea that Israel is the kind of friendly democracy that obeys international law that you can send armaments to as one democracy to another. And so I think that's the real symbolic meaning of these lawsuits, is asking a very harsh question about what kind of country Israel is, and should that make it an outlaw that someone like Canada shouldn't send weapons to?
Jack, let's stay in the region but shift the lens slightly to the Red Sea, because this week, three civilians were killed there after an attack on a key shipping route. These are attacks by Iran-aligned Houthi militants. They fired a missile at the Barbados-flagged Greek-operated ship called True Confidence on Wednesday. That was about 50 nautical miles off the southern Yemeni port of Aden. Now, the Houthis have kept up a pretty relentless campaign of attacks on vessels since November in what they say are attacks in solidarity with the Palestinians. Tell us about the ongoing response we've seen from the U.S. and what happens next.
So this is the fascinating way that the conflict has metastasized outside of Gaza. Of course, you've seen the conflict picking up between the United States and Iranian proxies in the region. That seems to have died down, but this Red Sea issue has kept on a boil. This missile attack showing, of course, countries are still going to need to divert shipping. There's been a lot of shipping diverted around the Horn of Africa. That's been a huge challenge. And the Houthis have really two objectives here. They want to sort of show they're the big man on campus in the region. As this conflict has broken out, there's a lot of different Iranian proxies. They, of course, have put their name more towards the top of the list, and they're not as closely linked with the Iranians as some of the other Iranian proxies. That's important to note as well, because they have a second objective here, and probably actually their first objective when you have to rank them, which is really to put leverage on the Saudi Arabians to get out of Yemen and to end their campaign in Yemen as well. So it seems like the Houthis are kind of taking an opportunistic tone towards this conflict, and it doesn't seem like they're prepared to stop, and they've just been able to develop all sorts of different types of weapon systems to harass the shipping lane.
Nancy, pull back the lens a little broader here. As Jack mentioned, the Houthis are part of this Iranian matrix of proxies operating in the region, with Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon. There have been, throughout this war, fears articulated about wider violence, about the war broadening in the region. Where do those concerns stand now?
Well, let's start with Iraq and Syria, where there was a real threat of that. Earlier this year and in the early months of the war, we had more than 170 attacks on U.S. troops during that time, killing three service members earlier this year. And then the U.S. killed a Khatib Hezbollah leader, and we've seen those attacks really subside, I think, amid fears that these attacks were going to lead to the kind of escalation that, while both sides were saying they didn't want, the Iranians at least were allowing their proxies to push closer to that proposition. The challenge, I think, more so is in with the Houthis, because the Houthis, I think, are less manageable by the Iranians than their proxies were in Iraq and Syria. And they're gaining tremendously domestically and even within the Arab world in their ability to be a thorn in the side of the West, to fundamentally change shipping through their actions. And so if we're looking at sort of where the Iranian influence is sort of the most meddlesome and troublesome, I think it's in its relationship with the Houthis. And I think one way that we've seen that is, while the U.S. has done all these attacks, both on sort of more static targets and even as the Houthis are setting up, we continue to see Iranian arms going through. There's nothing to suggest that these attacks, even in perpetuity, can really stop this threat, because the supply goes through essentially, and the Houthis continue to operate largely as independent actors of the Iranians relative to some of the proxies in other parts of the region.
Let's turn to Haiti now, where leaders have declared a state of emergency this week after armed gangs stormed two of the country's largest prisons.
We were asleep when we heard the sound of bullets. The cell barriers are broken. I'm the only one left in my cell.
Nearly 4,000 prisoners are believed to have escaped during the jailbreak. That is according to the Associated Press. Meanwhile, Haiti's acting prime minister, Ariel Henry, is stuck in Puerto Rico, where he was forced to land on Tuesday after the armed groups laid siege to Haiti's international airport in the capital of Port-au-Prince. Here now is Haitian gang leader Jimmy Cherizier, known as Barbecue.
If Ariel Henry does not step down, if the international community continues to support Ariel Henry, they will lead us directly into a civil war that will end in genocide.
David, tell us more about why Ariel Henry is facing pressure both from gangs inside Haiti and from President Biden to resign his post.
So he is not the legitimate elected leader of Haiti. He was the appointed prime minister when, as you say, that this violence really began in 2021 with the assassination of Haiti's elected president. And since then, you've seen the international community hoping that Ariel Henry was better than the armed gangs and warlords that had made such misery of life in Haiti. And so for a while, he was being propped up by a sense that if you could push him to move to a transitional government and to hold elections, he was the most stable figure out there. But essentially what we've seen in the last few weeks is that the Americans in particular, but other members of the international community, his neighbors in the Caribbean, have lost patience with Ariel Henry. And we saw the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, calling Ariel Henry, saying that there was now an urgent need to accelerate the transition to a more inclusive government, which is diplomatic speak for, you know, you need to pass off, you need to change, that the office needs to move to someone else, you know, and then towards elections. Ariel Henry says that there cannot be elections safely given the violence until August 2025. But as you said in your introduction, he himself has completely lost control of the situation because he had to go to Kenya to try and to sign an agreement to try and trigger the Kenyans' ability to send 1,000 police to Haiti as the leaders of what the Haitians have asked for as a multinational security force. While he was out of the country, that's when we saw the gang leaders that you played the clip of taking advantage of the situation to lay siege to the airport and release prisoners from prisons. And now he is essentially working out whether he dares go back to Haiti, whether it is safe for him to go back to Haiti, and some of his own neighbors blocking their airspace to prevent him going back into Haiti. And so there is a sense of a country which was already desperately poor, desperately ridden by crime, that did not have an elected government and hasn't had one for some time, is now sort of sliding into absolute chaos, with the strongest figures on the ground being warlords and gang leaders who have nothing but their own selfish interests at heart.
Jack, there was this push for a UN-backed police force from Kenya to go to Haiti. In some ways, the world's leaders were worried about increasing violence. What's the status of that Kenyan police deployment? And also, what could actually stop the violence on the ground from Haiti, if anything, right now?
Yeah, it's stuck in legal red tape and wrangling at this point. The Kenyan courts declared the deployment illegal back in January because under the Kenyan constitution, they're not supposed to deploy police forces to a foreign country unless they have a reciprocal deal in place with the host country. They seemed to get that deal earlier this week. The acting caretaker Prime Minister Henri agreed to let them put boots on the ground. We'll see if that's the breakthrough, but there's a lot of restlessness about actually putting these types of troops on the ground. We don't know how ready they are to fight in a lawless environment.
To Russia and their ongoing full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now, Germany launched an investigation over the weekend after Russian media published a leaked call between high-ranking German military officials. The sensitive call included discussions of supporting Ukraine by deploying cruise missiles to Kyiv. During a press conference on Tuesday, German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius confirmed the leak was caused by an individual error.
The damage is clear. Something like this should not have happened. Trust in us as a NATO partner is not broken. There are no such indications whatsoever because everyone knows it could happen to them. What's decisive are the technical and regulatory consequences, and we will address them. So I am angry about this incident. Very angry.
Nancy, the leaked call also detailed how British soldiers were on the ground in Ukraine helping to fire long-range missiles. And a Kremlin spokesperson said the information confirmed the involvement of, quote, a collective West. What sort of pressure is Germany under for this leaked call?
Well, there are a couple. One is that cruise missile that they were talking about, the Taurus cruise missile. And the reason it's significant is that it has a further range than some of the other missiles that have been provided by Western allies. And what we heard in that call was the officers talking about how they could be deployed. And we got a sense about how much the political pressure was shaping the German decision about whether to provide them. The concern that by providing them, it escalated tensions and put Germany at bigger risk in terms of threats from Russia. So there's that pressure in terms of the practicality of providing those cruise missiles. And then there's the security one. This happened because one of the four generals on the call, or I should say officers, I think they're all generals, was in a conference in Singapore and used an insecure line. And in doing so, he created an opportunity for Russia to publish a 38-minute audio of this and try to create fissures within the alliance at such a critical time of the war, as the United States is debating whether to provide $60 billion worth of aid, and as its European allies are looking at alternatives if that aid doesn't come through. And so I think if you're Germany, there are challenges in terms of how you support the battlefield and also how you keep the alliance together and not create potential rifts by having security breaches within it.
David, in related news on Russia's war in Ukraine, on Tuesday of this week, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for two senior Russian military commanders over alleged war crimes in Ukraine. The warrant was issued for, quote, missile strikes carried out by the forces under their command against the Ukrainian electric infrastructure. What should we understand about the situation that resulted in these warrants?
Well, listeners may remember that there was that awful series of months in the late 2022, the beginning months of 2023, where Russia was very deliberately targeting the electrical infrastructure of Ukraine, not just kind of big power plants. We had that battle for the nuclear power station at Zaporizhia, but also, you know, taking out electrical substations, taking out transformers again and again. The idea was that in the depths of the winter, they wanted to freeze Ukrainian civilians to make life wretched and miserable in that country. Now, under the rules of war, the laws of war, deliberate direction of attacks against civilians and civilian targets is a war crime. And so the International Criminal Court has issued these arrest warrants for two officers, one of whom was the commander of long-range aviation for the Russian Air Force at the time, and the other of whom, the admiral, was the commander of the Black Sea Fleet. And basically, it was their forces that were constantly pounding Ukraine's electrical infrastructure, as I say, to try and destroy the economy, but also to freeze civilians in the depths of winter. Having said that, are these two officers going to end up in an ICC courtroom? No, because Russia is not a party to the ICC. And so this is in some ways symbolic. But the naming of these officers, you saw the Ukrainian government responding and saying that this is, another sign that, you know, justice demands that these war crimes are punished one day. But I think it is it's a reminder that deliberate attacks on civilians that we're still seeing in Ukraine today have been the Russian sort of modus operandi since the beginning of this terrible, wicked conflict.
Also this week, big news on the military alliance front. Just yesterday, Sweden officially joined NATO as the 32nd member. This is 2 years after Sweden applied to join following the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Sweden's prime minister formally handed over documents to the U.S. State Department in Washington, D.C. in the final step of the process. Jack, what does this mean for the alliance and what Sweden brings to it?
This is a ground shift in terms of the alliance's geography and in terms of the territory that Russia has to defend. Experts in Washington, D.C. are calling the Baltic Sea now a NATO lake. The Swedes, the Finns, the Danes might not all agree with that. But Sweden, when you look at the geography, it's an archipelago, the world's largest archipelago of almost 300,000 islands. It's got a 2,000-mile-long coastline. And basically, even before the Swedes were in NATO, they were tracking Russian ships all the way from the North Sea to Kaliningrad and St. Petersburg. Both the Swedes, the Finns, the Danes, the Norwegians, they're looking at developing a joint air force together. So they're going to bring a lot of capability towards the alliance. There's questions of whether they can help out with the Baltic air policing mission that's been going on NATO's eastern flank. The Swedes are already going to deploy 100 troops to Latvia to help deal with that battle group. So this is a lot of capability potentially coming into the alliance, a lot that Russia has to deal with, both on its maritime border and in just reinforcing NATO with much more military capability.
I want to turn now to Sudan. The World Food Program is warning that the conflict raging between rival generals in Sudan is now creating the world's largest hunger crisis. 18 million people in Sudan face acute hunger, with the most desperate trapped behind the front lines of the fighting. On Thursday of this week, my colleague at the PBS NewsHour, Nick Schifrin, spoke to the chief of the World Food Program, Cindy McCain, while she was visiting South Sudan about the greatest needs in that conflict right now.
Well, to give you some idea, we're $300 million short this year. and to do the kind of job that we need to be doing and making sure not only that we're feeding, but that we're also caring for those longer term feeding problems like with malnutrition, especially with our children, our pregnant mothers. This year, the money has not come. But with that said, there is a responsibility to this particular region and to these people. Without our help and without the world's help and consideration, they are going to die.
Jack, the situation sounds absolutely dire. Give us a sense of the humanitarian circumstances on the ground in Sudan right now.
Yeah, it might be the world's worst humanitarian crisis, if not Gaza. Certainly one of the largest displacement crises in the world. 6.3 million people displaced since the fighting broke out in earnest last year. 1.6 million of them have crossed international borders, putting refugee camps in countries like Chad, South Sudan, and Ethiopia, which are not some of the most stable countries in the world. And you add to a pot of 14 million refugees in the whole East Africa region. Many of them have been displaced two, three, four times, uprooted again and again and again. The fighting has gotten so bad that the UN and NGOs don't have access to the areas controlled by the Rapid Support Forces. Now, that's the force that controls most of the capital of Khartoum. They've been getting backing from the UAE and Russia. And they've, of course, allied with some of the Janjaweed militia members and their descendants that were involved in the Darfur genocide of the last couple of decades. So as long as kind of this fighting continues between Burhan and Hamedi, the Rapid Support Forces commander, this sort of game of rock'em sock'em robots that they're kind of engaged in, you're not going to be able to see NGOs, humanitarian groups, the United Nations get the access that they need. And you haven't seen the pledges from the international community. Still 1.7 billion short of need. So just an incredible amount of need right there in the heart of Africa.
Nancy, as Jack rightly points out, the aid will depend on the fighting stopping for at least some portion of time. So what is the status of that conflict between these rival generals? What should we know about them? And is there any hope of a ceasefire?
Not imminently. We just heard last week the U.S. appointed a special envoy to Sudan looking to persuade foreign powers to adopt a united approach. And so the fact that that is the starting point, I think, is reason to not believe or assume that something's coming imminently. Moreover, we've heard that both generals have shown an utter disregard for the law, according to a Human Rights Watch report, that the conflict has spread beyond into the capital. And so there's not any indication right now of a cessation of hostilities. They both are fighting aggressively. Both generals, excuse me, are fighting aggressively. And there doesn't seem to be a united approach among U.S. allied partners and nations. And so I think that's one of the reasons you heard from Cindy McCain and others that in the absence of an imminent solution militarily, that there needs to be more funding and more done to get aid in. We heard in that PBS interview Cindy McCain say that they're having to cut down meals to one a day. And so there are two crises. There's the humanitarian one and the fact that we are so far away from any signals of an end to military hostilities. And can you resolve the former without resolving the latter? I think that's the challenge right now.
Well, with each month, it seems another climate record falls. This past February was the warmest in modern times, according to the EU's climate service. Each month since June of last year has now seen a new record high. David, you have to think back to 2015. Nearly 200 countries signed on to the Paris Climate Agreement. How close are we to exceeding the goal set there?
I mean, we're at the number already that they talked about, but it's about trend lines. Because, of course, when you're trying to make the case that something very scary and dangerous is happening to the climate, you can't talk about individual events. You look at trends. And people thought for a long time that this was going to be over many, many years and decades that we'd be watching these trends. What is really scary, terrifying, is the extent to which the warming of the globe is speeding up. So, as you say, in the Paris Climate Accords, what they agreed was that there was an urgent need to take action to stop the climate worldwide, on average, getting more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above its pre-industrial level. So basically, so, you know, you take as your benchmark pre-1900 temperatures over the average. Now, that is measured ultimately over several years. So it has to stay at that level over several years to trigger, you know, that the Paris Accord has failed. But nonetheless, as you say, we've seen over the last 9 months, every one of the last 9 months has broken the all-time record for the temperature in that given month. So it was the warmest February, before that it was the warmest January, before that the warmest December, and so on. And in February, it was 1.77 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So we're in a very dangerous place. And also the ocean temperatures are exceedingly scarily warm. They are well above where they need to be. And so there is a sense that records are falling in ways that it's just unmistakable. And if you look at places like, you know, some bits of Central Europe, in Romania, they were seeing weather that is normally kind of early summer, spring weather in the middle of winter. You're seeing, you know, places like the Great Lakes in the States not having anything like the kind of freezing winters that they should have had. And so there is a sense that all the trend lines are clearly pointing towards a real climate catastrophe, and quicker than we had feared.
I do want to turn now to another story from this week that is sure to be good news to fans of Spanish literature. 10 years after his death, the sons of Nobel laureate novelist Gabriel García Márquez published his last novel, Until August. Now, Jack, Gabriel García Márquez told his sons to rip up the book, which he'd been working on up until his death. Why is it being published now?
Yeah, I mean, this is the height of all irony, right? He told his sons to rip up the book entitled Memories of My Melancholy Horrors because, ironically, his memory wasn't good enough. He was suffering from dementia for the last decade of his life. He was telling his sons the book didn't work and that it must be destroyed. The sons are admitting that it's an act of quote-unquote betrayal as opposed to his written word and his will. But having looked at the manuscripts, there's enough Márquez in the book that they feel it's needed to get out there in the public light. And this is good news for me as a reader of a lot of older folks that might be sort of approaching the end days. I hope that we get more of their families producing their books despite their wishes.
Well, can I just go around the horn here and ask each of you to share in a sentence what you will be watching over this next week? Jack, kick us off.
Well, you mentioned Sweden, Omna. That's going to change the geography of NATO a lot because there's the question of whether the Swedes go and patrol the Atlantic Ocean and, of course, all of those underwater cables, or they continue to chase Russian ships in the Baltic Sea. So fascinating questions facing the alliance as it grows from 31 to 32.
Nancy?
Along the same themes, but in a different part of the world, that as we see the world try to respond to the crisis in Gaza, I'm curious how that changes alliances with nations in the region, both with Israel and with the United States.
And David?
Well, it is the annual session of Parliament here, but I confess it is, more importantly, my son's 21st birthday next week, and I'm about to get on a plane and go and see my family in England. So that's my week.
Happy birthday to him from all of us. And a big thank you to all of our panelists. That was David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist, co-host of the Drum Tower podcast, Nancy Youssef, National Security Correspondent at The Wall Street Journal, and Jack Detch, Pentagon and National Security Reporter at Foreign Policy. Thank you so much to you all. And if you haven't heard yet, we just launched 1A Plus. When you join 1A Plus, you get to listen to our show sponsor-free, and you're supporting our work. Go to plus.npr.org/the1A to find out more. Mike Kidd is our sound designer and engineer, with help from Kellen Quigley, Adrian Danhauser, and Kennedy Wright. Chris Castano is our digital editor. Maya Garg is our senior managing producer. AC Valdez is our senior supervising producer. Amanda Williams is our special projects editor. Aileen Humphreys is the editor and producer of 1A On Demand. And Barb Onguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour. This is 1A.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.